The Before Columbus Foundation and the been folks we've known for, 20-something or more years. And it's an organization, as the name suggests, Before Columbus, that they try to focus on either indigenous American literature, such as Native American or the Hispanic traditions, but now especially the multi-ethnic diversity of American literature and philosophy and thinking. So I think partly it's sort of a way to acknowledge publishers who do venture into that territory. So historically, the awards have gone to people working with Native American literature, Hispanic, Black, Asian American, and so on. So we're very, very, very happy that the book recognizes that. And of course, the people who are in the book, especially the people of Sitka. So this is a Sitka book in the true sense.
Was it really 20 years in the making?
Oh, yes. This started, the heart of it are the two narratives that we put at the end by Sally Hopkins and Alex Andrews. And these were recorded by the National Park Service way back in the 1950s, or maybe one was 1961. I think the Alex Andrews a little bit later. And these are two accounts of the battles of Sitka. And we were requested by Amy Nelson, who was the daughter of Sally Hopkins, if Nora was asked particularly, could she transcribe that, I mean, write it out in Thlinkit and translate it, because that had never been done before. It had been paraphrased and in translation, but, you know, never really in Sally's own words. And then likewise, the Alex Andrews, he was a child of Kiksutti, so he's telling it from his father's point of view. So that's the way it started. And the main thing that we do in our work is we only work with the support and the permission of the community. And at that time, the community was still divided as to a very fundamental question of who owns history. You know, and this may seem kind of strange to people, but it's a really a profound question. And in this case, is this history belong exclusively to the Thlinkits and more particularly to the Kiksutti of Sitka? Or there are other people involved. There were white Americans on both sides of the battle. There were Russians. There were Germans. There were, you know, a lot of different people. So that was an issue that had to be resolved. And some of the older generation said, no, we don't want to go public. And also for a very good reason that once peace has been made, you don't talk about a war. So they were saying we made peace with the Russians in 1805 and we don't want to reopen old wounds. So it took a while for this to work itself out. And then about 4 years ago, 5 years ago, maybe, we started getting a lot of support from the younger generation who said, gee, you know, we don't know this anymore. The time has come, I think, to move forward. So that was both good and bad. I think the sad part about waiting is so many of the elders have passed away. And these were people who could have helped us answer the questions that only come up when you're editing and you're in the final throes and you say, what does this mean? And who is this person's name? And what's this genealogy? And that generation is gone. On the positive side, way back, due to the restrictions with the Soviet Union, a lot of the material in the archives was not available to scholars either in Russia or in the United States. So with the end of what was called the Evil Empire, there was a lot more openness there, and we were able to really work with Russian colleagues, and archival material was open to us that we couldn't get before. So what's to me very beautiful about the book is that it presents both the Thlinkit and the Russian accounts in the primary documents, meaning this is Baranov's own handwriting, literally. It's Kuskov, it's the eyewitness accounts of the survivors, and then the Thlinkit accounts, although obviously not from people who were alive then, were from people whose grandparents were involved with the battles. So with Sally Hopkins, who was born in the 1870s, I mean, you have the the voice of somebody who heard this growing up. So it took 20 years, but we're happy. It's like the well-aged wine, I guess.
Yeah, I would say for anybody who's not familiar with primary source material on these events, the Russian colonial period, this book, especially some of these transcriptions of the Sally Hopkins interviews and some of the other oral traditions, they're things I haven't heard before, and they're told with a great sense of personal feeling and grief and pride, and it's the kind of thing that just hasn't really emerged before. Is this the record? Can we say definitively that we've captured all that we can from this episode?
Well, I know we haven't captured all because there are documents there, again, that are in Baranov's handwriting that we just didn't have time to get to. It takes several months to get up to speed on those, to figure out his handwriting. These were sort of the Daniel Crocketts and Davy Crocketts and Daniel Boones of their era, so the grammar wasn't completely standard Russian. So even for somebody who's a native speaker of Russian, it's very hard to read the handwriting and to figure out. There's words that are only used in Russian America, certain kinds of dry fish, you know, people from Moscow are totally clueless about. So there's stuff out there. We know that there's at least two or three more letters that we wanted to get in that are Baranov's understanding of his intelligence, like what the Tlingits were up to and his reports from here and there. So I think there's probably more out there. For the Tlingit side, probably this is going to be it, although there are still some probably there are some older recordings that we haven't transcribed yet. But it's amazing, and some of the stuff still is in archives and things that were unknown. But what was beautiful to us is the way the two accounts come together. And in some cases, we even have artifacts, for example, the possession plates. There's a good description from Baranov about where it was buried, and lo and behold, that was where the CCC found it in Sitka in the 30s. There's a place where Sally Hopkins mentioned Baranov gave a medal to one of the Tlingits and put it on his neck. And Lisiansky, in his report, says the same thing. He, you know, from on such and such a day it was done, and we still have that in the State Museum in Juneau. Then there's a very wonderful passage where in Lisiansky's logs he describes how they engaged in small arms fire with the Tlingits and the canoe blew up. And then it totally independently of that, as the account in a couple of the oral traditions by A.P. Johnson, and affected, I think it's in all of the oral traditions, and it's a primary Kiksuddy morning song to this day. The song was composed later in the 19th century, but it alludes to that event. So you have these kind of monumental events that are supported from both sides. But as I say, I still hope there's more out there in the archives that people will find, and diaries like this marvelous handwritten diary from Tarkhanov, who wrote it in 1795. He went up the Copper River with the Tlingits by foot. And then his diary was kind of moldering in the archives. So we hope there's more.
I wonder if this book, the mark that it'll make on Russian-American and Tlingit scholarship, is that it was the point where these stories converged, because I know that for several decades here in Sitka, the National Park, for instance, I think a lot of the account of the battle that took place in 1804 there is based on Lisiansky's logs, Lisiansky's recollections of the event, his publication of the story. And Western scholarship has always sort of embraced these kinds of primary source materials and put oral tradition on maybe a second tier. And all of a sudden, these two are kind of united in this book, and they sort of mutually validate and corroborate each other.
Oh, I think definitely. And it also, reminds us, though, we do have to be cautious because not all oral accounts are accurate and not all written accounts are. And that's been a problem. A lot of the written accounts were taken as gospel, even though they were by people are Lydia Black likes to call a juvenile delinquent, some of these guys that were kids in the Navy, and they spent a week in, you know, Kodiak on board talking to people, and you know, this goes down as the gospel. And so some of these things have to be taken with a grain of salt. But certainly the core of this, there are very reliable oral traditions, there are very reliable eyewitness accounts. But one thing that's always amusing to me is when you read the same account from two different points of view, like when von Langsdorff and DeWolf paddle from Sitka out to Point Craven, you got these two guys wintering in Sitka, and DeWolf was the optimist and Langsdorff was the pessimist, and Langsdorff is just how crummy and rotten Sitka is, and everything's falling apart, and there's nothing good here. And DeWolf saying, "Ah, oh, this is great. We're having a wonderful time." So even when you have two people who are roommates and paddling adjacent kayaks, you're gonna get different points of view. So you have to kind of sort that out.
Is there anything that you and Nora encountered in compiling this book that substantially alters the way we should perceive these battles of 1802 and 1804 in Sitka?
Well, I think two things. One is Lydia liked to make the point that so much of our earlier understanding was based on Cold War propaganda. You know, this is the nasty Russians, and then the Thlingets get crabby and have this uprising. And so there's a certain little bit of nastiness in the Russians, but you kind of have to admire Baranov as you look. Here's this guy in his 60s paddling through, you know, in his kayak. And and then also that from the Thlinket point of view, this was a very, very well-calculated attack. It wasn't just a bunch of disgruntled, you know, stereotype Indians shooting from the bush. You know, that these guys planned this out. There were simultaneous attacks at Dry Bay and at Cake and at Sitka. So it was very well thought out. So, and I like to compare this sometimes to like the Battle of Midway or the Battle of the Alamo, that in and of itself, the turf was probably not that important, but like the Battle of Midway, whoever controlled the real estate controlled the North Pacific. So whoever controlled Sitka controlled the fur trade for the North Pacific, and you had the Russians and the English and the Spanish and the Americans and the Brits all competing for this territory, and naturally the Thlingets had a stake in it because it was their territory and they wanted to control the trade. So I think what it does is it opens up the complexity of this, you know, which had never really, I think, been looked at. So like the Battle of the Alamo, I mean, the Battle of Sitka was probably ultimately a relatively insignificant battle as far as battles go. As far as the future map, I mean, look at the way that it defined the map of North America, with Alaska being becoming Russian territory and then ultimately a part of the United States. And probably if that hadn't happened, it might have become part of Hudson Bay territory and then part of Canada, part of the British Empire. So I think there's a lot of complexity that we're just becoming aware of and looking at it through from the Thlinket point of view as well as the Russian point of view.
And lastly, Lydia Black did not survive to see this book published, but do we credit Lydia Black with the work in penetrating the archives back in Russia?
Very much so. Nora and I invited Lydia to join us on this book when, as we waited these 20 years, you know, it started out just with these Thlinket accounts, and gradually it just grew and grew, and we started discovering more and more stuff. And Lydia, of course, spent her life, especially her later part of her career, specializing in this area. She was a native speaker of Russian. She was very, very well versed in 18th century handwriting and manuscript work, and had a lot of colleagues in Russia. So she was incredible. And I keep telling her daughter, I got so mad at Lydia for dying on us because she was just the source of information. I could get on the telephone and say, Lydia, what's going on here? And she could tell me. But then, you know, after she died at about early in a year or so ago, and I realized it's like growing up. All of a sudden, you've got to do these things for yourself. And I said, "Oh boy, I'm in the driver's seat now, and I've got to sort some of these things out." So she was incredibly helpful and inspirational in that part of the book. I'd also, while we're thanking people, just like to mention again the support from Sitka, because without the support, especially of the younger house leaders, we wouldn't have brought this through. And Andy Hope, who died this summer, was very helpful in as a community liaison person. And one unsung person that people don't know too much about is Michael Travers, who is our book designer, and he kind of makes it all look beautiful. So we're really, a lot of people helped us, especially when you look at the book, all the different contributors. So we had people from the Tlingit community and the National Park Service and scholars from here and there all being supportive and contributing.